This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and we begin today in the Middle East, where the terror from the air is afflicting the people of Gaza and the people in coastal towns of Israel. Rocket attacks answered with Israeli airstrikes. Here is the sound of emergency vehicles descending on a burning vehicle in Gaza City. There have been casualties, and I mean deaths, on both sides now. Israelis have died in rocket attacks, adding to the dead in Gaza, including Hamas military leader Ahmed al-Jabari. Witnessing this escalation is reporter Isabel Kirshner with our partner, The New York Times. We spoke with her earlier today as she was huddled in an Israeli community near the coast, watching for and listening to the rockets fall.
At the moment, I'm in Sderot, which is an Israeli border town very near the Gaza border. And literally in the last 5 minutes, there have just been three different red alerts, which is the local kind of siren, which alerts people to incoming rockets. You then hear the rockets flying overhead, and then you hear a boom. And I think three or four seem to have fallen in or around the town in the last 5 minutes. So we'll be going to take a look and see where they fell. But basically this morning, you know, it's been more of the same, more Israeli warplanes targeting militant sites in Gaza, and many rockets coming over from Gaza into southern Israel. This morning, we were a little earlier, we were in Kiryat Malachi, which is the town where three people were killed this morning when a rocket hit an apartment block. So it really is beginning to heat up on both sides.
What kind of rockets are these that are coming from Gaza?
Well, there are different ranges and different types. There are the shortest range Qassam rockets, which are usually locally produced, and they fall within, you know, a few miles radius. But what's been happening in recent years, and one of the reasons the Israeli military says it has had to now mount this operation, there's been a large weapons buildup, and now there are much more sophisticated weapons there, including mid-range and longer-range rockets. They call them grads. They're a kind of Katyusha type of rocket, which are mostly smuggled in and not locally made. And they can reach, you know, we're talking about at least 20 miles or more from Gaza. There are rockets that are in Gaza that the authorities are telling us have the capability of reaching Tel Aviv, but apparently none of those have been fired yet. So.
What sense of escalation is there here, and at what point does a full-scale mobilization begin to seem like a possibility?
Well, I can only tell you that on the way down here, I saw quite a lot of very heavy military vehicles being moving down south. They looked like the kind of vehicles that would be used in a ground operation, a ground invasion. So there certainly seem to be preparations underway for that. We've been hearing about some very limited call-up specialist reserves. We've heard about some infantry being shifted around and redeployed. So certainly preparations are in place for an Israeli ground operation as well, although the Israeli authorities are saying that, you know, all options are open, but we're not there yet. So I think basically it's pretty critical what happens in the next 24 to 48 hours on both sides, and to see whether, you know, we're going into a much longer campaign or not.
Isabel, last question. Have Israeli authorities commented on the timing of the Israeli airstrike yesterday that killed the Hamas military leader Ahmed al-Jabari?
Well, they haven't commented very specifically, but there have, you know, in the last two rounds of cross-border violence, the last one having started on Saturday, the leaders in Israel have been warning more and more explicitly about the need for a broader operation. So it seemed like it was coming. Many people thought that it was, you know, threats and warnings to try and deter the other side because, as you know, we have elections coming up here in 9 weeks. And on the one hand, while this operation so far has very huge support in Israel, On the other hand, it's always risky because you know where these things begin and you never know where they're going to end.
Isabel Kirshner, Jerusalem-based reporter for our partner, The New York Times, speaking to us from Sderot in southern Israel. Isabel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For more on the wider implications of what seems to be a deteriorating situation between Israel and the people of the Gaza Strip, we turn now to Aaron David Miller, vice president of the Woodrow Wilson Center and former U.S. Middle East negotiator. First of all, Aaron David Miller, welcome back to the show. What do you make of these circumstances, of what's going on?
Pleasure to be here, John. Look, I think it's old wine, sadly, tragically, in new bottles. And I think there are three or four new factors driving this recent escalation. One is you've got a number of jihadi groups operating in Gaza, some former Hamas members, some outliers, who have simply picked up the pace of their willingness to strike out, apart from Hamas's own tactics. Second, you've got a concentration now of Hamas in Gaza. The external leadership is out of Damascus, and you've got a real determination on the part of the Hamas military wing in Gaza to demonstrate that they are the legitimate actors and to become the so-called tip of the spear against the Israelis. And then finally, you've got a set of Israeli circumstances. You've got elections coming up January 22nd. Netanyahu is under pressure to respond much more aggressively from pressures from these southern Jewish communities. And the broader issue of regional deterrence, I think the Israelis, or at least it's the prime minister's perception, that combination of Iran, deterioration relations with Egypt, groups that are operating in Sinai, give him a real stake in demonstrating that the Israelis will act if their interests are threatened. All of these things have come together to essentially put at risk more or less a relatively stable situation since 2008. And it's got the potential to escalate, even though I'd argue that neither the Israelis nor Hamas wanted to do so.
Let's take a look at what other forces may be driving this. What you're describing seems to me a sense of Gaza is adrift because the control that Egypt formerly exerted is no longer the case because of the Arab Spring turmoil in Egypt. And within Gaza, Hamas is unable to control other forces that are adrift because Hamas's control in Damascus is preoccupied by the other Arab Spring turmoil that we're dealing with in Syria. Is this bloodshed that really is a consequence of Arab Spring-led chaos in the region?
There's no question, John, that these kinds of uncertainties have threatened what I would argue was a fairly functional relationship between two entities, the State of Israel and Hamas as a legitimate and major part of the Palestinian national movement, essentially to maneuver around one another without repeating the circumstances that led to Operation Cast Lead when in 2008-09 when the Israelis in several weeks went into Gaza in a major way. Neither side wants that, but these new uncertainties, particularly the fact that in Egypt you have a situation in which the current Egyptian government is caught between supporting Hamas on one hand, after all, the Brotherhood in Egypt. Hamas is an offshoot of the Brotherhood in Egypt on one hand, and not wanting Hamas to drag it into a regional war on the other. So that control mechanism is broken. Omar Suleiman, used to head up Egyptian intelligence, by now would have been active in pressing both the Palestinians and the Israelis to desist. You don't have that right now. And you've got a Morsi government, essentially a Muslim Brotherhood government, that literally is caught between its own desire to sympathize, empathize, and support Hamas and its Muslim brothers against Israel on one hand and not wanting this to get out of control on the other. So, yeah, I think that the Arab Spring slash winter has introduced a whole range of uncertainties. You combine that with these errant artillery shells and mortars across the Golan Heights, with Sinai that is increasingly slipping out of Egyptian control, where these jihadi groups, some of which are active in Gaza, are operating there as well. And you see what small, determined groups can do in an effort to embroil broader and regional forces in the prospects of a major confrontation.
You know, I'm wondering if there is an option, a statesmanlike option, for Mohamed Morsi in Egypt to basically come in here, consistent with his own limitations, as you've described them, but still more aggressively to try to be more of a mediator here.
I think he may try. In large part because he has other equities. I mean, right now the IMF, he's negotiating with the IMF for $4.5 billion loan. He needs American support. He needs the Americans essentially to be his lawyers on this one, and to argue for the IMF and for international support to Egypt. And he certainly doesn't want to tie himself to Hamas's rhetoric or their military operations, particularly if the group, in an effort to avenge Ahmed Jaberi's death, goes back to attacking civilians using suicide terror tactics inside of Israel. That would be a disaster for Morsi and his party. So I think there is a stake. The question is whether or not they have the kind of influence and are willing to work both with the Palestinians and the Israelis. We don't know the answer to that. I suspect that both sides will try to avoid the kind of escalation that led in 08 and 09 to Operation Cast Lead. Neither of them wants that, but the next few days will tell.
But there's a real wild card here, and let's conclude on the note that you raised a moment ago, the Golan Heights, looking to Syria. I mean, any serious escalation across the Golan, and all bets are off.
Yeah, and again, I think what remains of the Assad regime, certainly the Israelis have no stake in converting what had been the quietest, still the quietest space in the Middle East since Kissinger negotiated a disengagement agreement way back in 1974, turning that space into a free fire zone. I think no one wants that, but it does add to increasing uncertainties in a region that, frankly, has more moving parts now than at any time I can remember.
Do you think there could be escalation? Sure, nobody wants it, but, what we've seen over the last few days is very disturbing.
It is, but I think, you know, it's telling that it's not the Northern Front that has activated, it's the Southern Front. And I think that the logic, if there is going to be an escalation, it's going to happen between Israel and Hamas, Israel and the jihadis in Gaza, not with what remains of the Syrian regime across the Golan. Assad has enough problems, and while conspiracy theories abound in this region, you know, you could make the argument that Syrian opposition is interested in drawing Israel into a conflict in order to bring Israeli military to pressure to bear against the Assads. I don't believe that. I think there is a kind of a natural equilibrium that will prevent the Golan from exploding.
Aaron David Miller will take that as a reassuring analysis from the vice president of the Woodrow Wilson Center and former U.S. Middle East negotiator. Thanks so much.
A pleasure, John. Take care.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.